there were a lot of stresses everywhere. I was trying to get back into work. Financially, we were struggling. I had three children and I was on my own.
I used to have a business which we ended up having to close. And that resulted in losing my employment. I lost my income and ended up losing my accommodation.
Aaron, and before him, Pauline. Two people with problems. But while Pauline suffered from depression, Aaron did not. At times, not surprisingly, Aaron's mood has become low. But outright depression, no. Some researchers think that one way of helping Pauline would be to understand Aaron. I'm Jeff Watts, and in this and the next edition of Discovery from the BBC World Service, I'll be asking two different but related questions. First, the obvious one. Why do any of us get depressed? Why has natural selection rid us of this unpleasant and apparently unhelpful state of mind? Why haven't our brains evolved in such a way that we don't experience this extra burden of misery when confronted with real difficulties like Pauline's? I'll also be turning the question round. As life events able to trigger depression are so common, how come a majority of us don't get depressed? What is the resilience that people like Aaron seem to possess? And if we could understand it, could we exploit it? But those are issues for next time. It's the question of why depression exists that I'll be tackling in this program. We need to know, not least on account of the number of people affected by it.
We think that about a fifth of the population will suffer from diagnosable symptoms of depression at some point in their lifetime.
Bill Deakin is Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Manchester.
It seems to be increasing in frequency. And so if you look at the prevalence of depression in the population and the age of onset, the prevalence is increasing and the age of onset seems to be getting less over succeeding decades. You know, we don't quite know why that is. I mean, there's more diagnosis of depression and general practitioners, which is where most depression presents, are much more sensitive to detecting it and understand much better than they used to that depression could be a manifested in different ways, and people turning up with physical symptoms, for example, and aches and pains that won't go away and feeling generally unwell when the real underlying problem is depression.
I think with each time that I've suffered from depression, it's the isolation, and emotionally I was very detached. I would come in and sit by my bed and cry. And when it got so bad that I didn't want to speak to my children, that's when I went to the doctors.
Pauline, reminding us how debilitating depression can be. So debilitating, in fact, that it leaves you wondering why it still exists. Why hasn't evolution by natural selection removed this irksome trait and left us happy, happy, happy all the time? Surely we'd then be better adapted to deal with life's difficulties. Or could it be that depression has an upside, some virtue, some benefit, of which we're unaware? And could treating it, in some cases at least, have a downside? One man who studies disease and its origins from an evolutionary point of view, indeed he practically invented the field, is Professor Randolph Nessie of the University of Michigan.
You know, I started off interested in psychiatry in particular and quickly realized that I was missing important things that were there in the rest of medicine. And that led me to really 20 years trying to develop the field of evolutionary medicine. Turns out there are new questions that haven't been systematically addressed. Mainly, why isn't the body better designed? I mean, why do we have an appendix? Why do we all have wisdom teeth that are so problematic? Why is the birth canal so narrow? Why do we all have so much excessive pain? Why do we get so sweaty in hot environments? These are questions that have two kinds of answers. One kind of answer we call approximate or mechanistic answer, how the body works. That's most of medical research. But the perspective George Williams and I took on these questions is to try to ask, why on earth didn't natural selection make the body better? Some things in the body are so great, like the eye and the knee joint and the heart valves. So why leave these other parts really apparently poorly done indeed?
It also seems to show why disease is not just arbitrary failure. It makes more sense, I guess, if you look at it in evolutionary terms, doesn't it?
It certainly does. I mean, there are aspects of disease that probably are just arbitrary failure. Cystic fibrosis results from a mutation, and that's that. Maybe it has some adaptive significance, but I rather doubt it. So there are different explanations for different kinds of diseases. But for every disease, we really need to ask, what variations are there, and why do we have bodies that have variations that leave us vulnerable to disease?
When it comes to depression, evolutionary theorists have several ways of explaining its persistence. Not all of them agree with Randolph Nessy, but, as we'll hear, his views do have the advantage of being backed by some experimental evidence. I asked him why he thinks that a capacity to get depressed might be beneficial, might be adaptive. Turns out this was not a good idea.
That's not the right question in my mind. The question is why we have a capacity for mood. And so many people assume that all depression is abnormal, and a great majority of it is, that it gets very confusing if you try to talk about the adaptive benefits of depression per se. I think the question is, why on earth have mood? Some people don't have much mood. They don't get especially happy. They never get especially sad. They just go on and on, pretty even-keeled. But most of us do have up times and down times, and the question is, why?
And the answer is?
There are times in life when investing a lot and taking a lot of risks pays off handsomely. When the crops are ripe and a thunderstorm is brewing, you had better get out there and gather everything as fast as you can. When you have a big opportunity to be in front of your group and say things that might be useful or interesting, you'd better be there and do it well. There are other times in life, unfortunately, however, when the more effort you put in, the more you're wasting effort and the more risks you're taking. For some of my ancestors in Norway in the middle of the winter, when there wasn't any game to get and any time you went out you were liable to die, the best thing to do was nothing. Now, there are times like that, fewer of them in modern societies, but there certainly were times like that.
Having the goal of wanting a secure job and a partner and buying a house and all that, and I just, that bout of depression really made me think, well, this job's making me unhealthy. And this relationship is unhealthy for me. At the time, I thought the best thing to do was to just get out. It has. It was.
We're all trying to do things throughout our lives, and usually things are working. We're gathering food and getting friends and helping our neighbors and doing things that are working. Unfortunately, there are some things that we're trying to do that just aren't working, and the more effort we put in, the worse it gets. For instance, I saw a patient recently who was desperately depressed, and it turned out the problem was that this person had dedicated her life to helping her child stay off drugs, and now he was addicted to heroin. And worse yet, the more she called and the more she tried to help, the more he pushed her away. She was dedicating her entire life to this goal and not making any progress whatsoever. You can readily understand why a mother couldn't give up on a goal like this, but nonetheless, it was plunging her into a deep depression.
So, much of natural selection is about helping us strive for evolutionary goals, for survival. And as Pauline's experience shows, the goals in our lives today, shaped by our desires and the society we live in, are still powerful drivers of behaviour and emotion. Randolph Nessy's view is that an inability to fulfil these goals is what triggers low mood. Surprising as it might seem, perhaps mild depression is in itself a way of building some sort of resilience within sufferers to help mitigate future bouts of low mood.
Much of medicine is using medications to block normal, aversive, defensive responses such as pain, nausea, fever, vomiting, and anxiety in low mood. And in most cases, it's perfectly safe because natural selection has shaped these responses to be greater than they really need to be in the individual circumstance. This is best described as something Williams and I have talked about as the smoke detector principle. When we all put up with lots of false alarms on our smoke detectors because we want to be absolutely sure the smoke detector goes off when there's a fire, even though there is the constant mild annoyance when the smoke detector goes off when we boil tea or make a piece of toast. Likewise, natural selection has shaped the regulation for things like fever, nausea, vomiting, pain, and I think low mood and anxiety, according to the smoke detector principle. These mechanisms are very sensitive. They go off a lot of times when they're not needed, but this is still perfectly normal because the system has to ensure that they go off in situations when they are needed.
So the smoke alarm principle may be one explanation for the increasing prevalence of depression. It's an ancient biological system, far too sensitive for modern life, especially in a culture which proclaims that only losers quit, even when quitting may be beneficial. Randolph Nessie and Carsten Roche hypothesise that low mood helps us to recognise when our ambitions are too lofty. If they're right about this, depression is delivering a message we do well not to ignore.
It's a part of me. And while the episodes have been quite negative, I do think that I've gained a lot of strength from it. I think it has helped me to look at the stress within my life and to seek strategies for dealing with it. So I do think it has been of great benefit to me, and the balance that I've found just lately in my life has helped a lot. And I don't think that would have come about so soon in my life if I hadn't had the depression.
So even Pauline, someone who suffered the real misery of depression, can see how it may be helpful in spurring the adoption of new goals.